You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Does concern about climate change depend on the culture where you live? If you know more about it, will you be more likely to support action? New research has some answers which may surprise you. Our guest, Joseph Arvai, is an expert in how decisions are made by humans. He's the Max McGraw Professor of Sustainable Enterprise and the director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. Joe is also co-author of a new paper in the journal Nature Climate Change. Joseph Arvai, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It seems like a basic assumption we may all have, the more we know about climate change, the more we will be concerned about it or even motivated to change. True or false?
You know, it seems intuitive that that would be the case. So the answer is kind of two-pronged. Some new research that's emerging on the importance of culture would say, no, not so much. But that counterintuitive finding is what we wanted to look more deeply into. And in our case, what we're finding is that, yes, indeed, knowledge does matter an awful lot.
Is scientific literacy necessary to care about climate change?
This is a really interesting question. So no, I think this is kind of the crux of some of the concerns we had with some of the research that's emerging on this topic. Most research that looks at how much people know about climate change is measuring exactly what you asked about, general scientific literacy. And what we find when we look at general scientific literacy is that no, it doesn't tend to correlate very strongly with concern about climate change or the willingness to act on climate change. On the other hand, if we look at more domain-specific knowledge about climate change, that does play a larger role. So I think that's the problem, is how we actually are looking at knowledge and then making inferences about what sort of general literacy says about climate change, which, you know, I think is something that only tells a very small part of the story.
Now, in a press release about this study, there was something that kind of worried me. It says, quote, greater knowledge about the biophysical dimensions of climate change tended to dampen public concern, end quote. What does that mean?
Well, if we look at how people sort of assemble their knowledge about climate change, we can look at a number of different factors. One of them is what's causing climate change. Another factor is what are the impacts of climate change going to be. And then a third factor would be kind of the biophysical elements of climate change. This is all of sort of the technical stuff that explains what climate change is. So it's about CO2 concentrations and the greenhouse gas effect, and it's very scientific. What we found is the more people tended to know about that particular kind of crunchy scientific kind of detail, the minutiae about climate change, the more they knew about that, the less concerned they were about climate change. We think that's because whenever you talk about sort of the technical elements of a problem, instinctively we as human beings tend to dehumanize it. We sort of lose sight of what's actually going on and what does that mean for the things that we care about. So it kind of makes sense when we think about this that the more you would sort of focus on the technical dimensions, the more kind of insensitive you would be to the actual sort of human and environmental consequences of climate change. And that, in turn, I think, is what accounts for this dampening of concern that we measured.
This is disastrous news for me, Joe, because as a science broadcaster, I spend a lot of time talking with experts about the details of how Earth systems respond to greenhouse gases. And if I'm actually dampening public concern, maybe I should change over to sort of a talk show chat format or something.
Yeah, I certainly don't mean to be critical of you or people in your profession or the many others who I think are doing, you know, really great work on getting the message out about what climate change is and what it means. I think the bigger picture for me is I'm not going to come out and say, you know, don't talk about this dimension of climate change or don't talk about that dimension of climate change. What I will say, though, is that if we really want to move the needle in terms of concern and if we want to move the needle in terms of action vis-a-vis the decisions that both individuals can make and also policymakers can make, I think we need to really have a frank conversation about what's causing it and what the impacts are going to be. It's not a function of curtailing the conversation or going to one kind of discussion over the other, but it's really to provide sort of a robust treatment of what the overall kind of nature of the climate problem is. And frankly, while that's important, and our research demonstrates that that's important, it's still not enough. I mean, there's much more that we would need to do to actually move the needle in terms of impact that goes beyond people raising concern. But I guess the key thing for me is a more well-rounded treatment of the different dimensions of climate change in our sort of public outreach and public education and policymaker education efforts is really what we need to be focusing on.
And meanwhile, I think we're going to continue to talk amongst ourselves. Now, a second pool of assumptions involves the idea that various cultures will react differently to climate change. What is cultural cognition?
Cultural cognition is a really interesting body of research that's emerging. It sort of had its birthplace is at Yale, where a number of researchers are looking at the role of cultural variables in a population and what those cultural variables mean for people's concern about a variety of things, climate change being one, nanotechnology being another, gun control being yet another. And what they're really looking for is to what extent do people's cultural sort of descriptors, which they might wear as sort of badges of honor, so to speak, to what extent do those cultural descriptors influence people's perceptions about and concern for a variety of different things that are sort of topical in the news these days.
And what cultures did you study for the paper in Nature Climate Change?
What we tried to do was to look not at different countries as exemplars of different cultures, which I think is something that a lot of cultural researchers end up doing. And in turn, what they really end up doing is not measuring culture at all. They measure political ideology in different places, the United States, for example, as a proxy for culture. What we wanted to do instead was look at what are the different dimensions that make up sort of someone's kind of cultural composition. And that includes things like to what extent they believe in hierarchical orders in society, that those who work the hardest deserve the most benefit. To what extent do people ascribe to altruistic worldviews in their lives? To what extent do people feel connected to the environment as sort of kind of key ingredients of what encompasses or what would sort of make up our individual cultural badge, if you will? And then to really get a robust picture of culture, we then looked at those different dimensions across six countries: China, Canada, the United States, the UK, Germany, and Switzerland. And through that kind of more in-depth process, that deeper dive, we were able to, I think, come up with a much richer picture of cultural variability, which we could then plug into some research on what culture and also knowledge would mean for concern about climate change.
Now, we both know that American ideas flow out to the world through television and movies and brand name products and tech. How does this American influence show up in research about attitudes towards climate change, or does it?
You know, I think it does. And this is not meant to be a critique of any individual researcher or any individual school of thought on how we should measure things. But I think there's a tendency for research, particularly research that comes out of the United States, for the different variables that get used as sort of the predictor variables in a study like the one that we did, to be heavily skewed in the direction of what could loosely be described as American culture. So if I look at the work that's coming out of some of our partner institutions, you know, culture is personally not what I think they're measuring in a robust way, with all due respect to them. I think what they're really measuring is American political ideology. So it's, you know, where do you fall on the left-right divide in the United States? Are you way on the right-hand side where Donald Trump is sitting? Are you just kind of left of center where Hillary Clinton sits? Or are you way left of center where Bernie Sanders sits? And that gets used as the proxy for what culture is. And I think if we look at studies of concern about things like climate change or gun control or abortion or nanotechnology in the United States, it makes a great deal of sense to look at those kinds of variables as a driver of concern about those different issues. But if we really want to measure the impact of culture, and if we really want to measure the impact of culture and compare it with the impact of something like knowledge, I think we need to dig a whole lot deeper than kind of an American political ideology as a proxy for culture.
And I've often wondered how people in China, the citizens not directly involved with the government, perceive climate change. How do they see it? What did you find out about that?
You know, China was an interesting outlier in our research. So concern for climate change was certainly there, but it wasn't nearly as strong as we saw it in some of the other countries. So if we look at a country like Germany or Switzerland, concern about climate change was very powerful. If we look at countries like the UK and Canada and the US, also a great deal of concern about climate change. If we look at China, significantly less concern about climate change. We have some theories about why that might be, but it was really a stark finding.
You are tuned to Radio Ecoshock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Joe Arvai from the University of Michigan. We're talking about a new paper he co-authored. The title is Knowledge as a Driver of Public Perceptions About Climate Change Reassessed. It's in the journal Nature Climate Change, published April 25th, 2016. Other authors are from the Institute for Environmental Decisions in Zurich, Switzerland. Well, in a presentation you made at the University of Calgary, you suggested an ethical oil station with a menu of choices based on the sources, the carbon emissions, and more. I think that's a super idea. What if we had informed choice at the pumps about the fossil fuel products we buy?
Oh, boy. I think your listeners in Alberta in particular don't want to hear this. If you presented people with a gas station where you could pull up the different pumps and choose different kinds of gasoline based on where in the world they came from, what we found is that based on people's priorities about the different kind of elements of what goes into making gasoline, from the environmental implications to the kind of tailpipe greenhouse gas implications to things like human rights considerations and the reputation of the country that produces the oil, oil from the oil sands in Alberta comes in last place, unfortunately. Whether it's oil from Canada, to some extent oil from Nigeria, which is not known for a strong human rights record, at the end of the day, the environmental implications associated with pulling that kind of oil out of the ground really stands out in people's minds as a reason not to buy it. Other sources of gas from the United States and oil from Saudi Arabia, suddenly becomes much more popular amongst consumers.
It's not a pretty choice, though, as you say. So while you were at the University of Calgary, you were swimming upstream for sure. For example, as a former Michigan boy, you said Calgary could become the next Detroit. Why would you say that?
You know, this goes back to, I think, the conversation that we were just having about energy and oil. The comparison I was drawing was one where in Detroit, the city's wealth and services were built upon an industry that really did only one thing and did that one thing very well until they didn't. So as the automobile industry rose in Detroit, population grew, what it meant to be a Detroiter in terms of the services you enjoyed really became quite exceptional. And then over time, as more competitors came into the marketplace and as attitudes about transportation and automobiles began to shift, Detroit slipped a little bit. And as a result of that, people who had the money and could move did move. You saw a lot of people move from the city to the suburbs where they perceived that they would have a more affluent lifestyle. And then ultimately, we saw the collapse in Detroit. In Calgary, I was arguing that we were on the path to the same thing. I wrote this piece, I think it was back at the tail end of 2013. You could just see over the horizon that prices for oil were likely to dip. At the same time, you could see all of this growth in a city like Calgary with great new services, a burgeoning population. And my concern was if kind of the appetite for the product that Alberta and in particular Calgary was making and making well suddenly slipped, you could see the same kind of crumbling and unfortunately collapse in Calgary that you saw in Detroit. I think the sad kind of end note to that story is, you know, that's kind of happening in Calgary right now. I think the city is in some pretty tough times. The province is scrambling to try and figure out what to do. I just read in the paper the other day that pipelines are back on the table. The Premier of Alberta has done a big about face on pipelines, which is something that she campaigned against when she was running a year ago. So I think there's the ingredients for a crisis there. I really hope they're able to pull out of it.
I think you're absolutely right. I had a relative in Calgary. He was working in a subsidiary to the oil industry, lost his job, had to sell a house and get out. Meanwhile, they just built a brand new hospital so large that it had a shopping mall built within it. They've got new roads built all over the place. The suburbs were expanding out into the prairies. nobody knows what's going to happen there right now.
Yeah, no, it's, I think the situation is potentially dire. I know that there are a lot of really good people out in Alberta and in Calgary working on this. I know that the new Prime Minister in Canada has made kind of revitalizing Alberta a priority. I remain hopeful, and in particular, I hope that this is the kind of wake-up call that gets people in a place like Alberta to realize that in order to protect itself against the kinds of shocks that are likely to happen when you rely on only one sector of the economy so heavily, that they'll begin to diversify their portfolio when it comes to certainly energy, but other things that the province can do well. Alberta and Calgary in particular have sort of touted themselves as Canada's energy capital. In fact, I think the slogan of Calgary has just been changed to feel the energy. And unfortunately, in my personal opinion, I think Calgary and Alberta is really the oil sands capital. It's not the energy capital. And I think there's an opportunity to be the energy capital, but it's going to require some fundamental changes in how the city and the province think about its future prospects.
Sure, if they could get a solar or wind industry. There are a lot of wind machines in Alberta, but that's another topic for another day. Joe Arvai, you are an expert in something called decision science. What is that?
Decision science is kind of this interesting, never dull marriage between psychology and economics and a few other disciplines. Basically, it's divided into three different parts. One part is what do economic and psychological theories tell us about how people should make their decisions if they were perfectly rational beings. The second part is focused on how do people actually make decisions, recognizing that they're not perfectly rational beings. And then the third part, which is what's really interesting to me, is how do you bridge the gap between those two things? If we know that perfectly rational people ought to behave in this way and that people who are not perfectly rational behave in this different way, how can we sort of bridge that divide so that we improve the quality of both individual and group decision making about a variety of things, ranging from individual decisions at the household or consumer level all the way on up to the biggest policy decisions of our time?
Our recent history is littered with spectacularly bad decisions with consequences, really bad ones. I mean, the decision by the Australian government to double down on coal comes to mind. And of course, George W. Bush's classic invasion of Iraq is maybe the worst decision this century so far. Why do governments make such bad decisions?
It's hard to come up with a single diagnosis, but in my view, I think some of the biggest problems are that people don't really look carefully at how they bound the decision problems or opportunities that they're confronted with. People like to take complicated decisions and simplify them. People like to take decisions that require long-term planning and an analysis of a series of linked decisions, and they like to boil those down into just one-off decisions that they can make and forget about. So that's one part of the problem. Another part is that people don't think very deeply about the range of objectives that really ought to be in play when they make decisions, especially complicated ones. And then building off of that, how you would actually measure progress or success or failure when it comes to those individual objectives. So, for example, if we had a room with 10 policymakers and they all agreed that protecting the environment is important, I'll bet that we would get 10 different answers on how you would measure progress with respect to environmental protection. A third dimension is people just don't do themselves a favor when it comes to looking at alternatives. You know, when we make a decision, we really ought to give ourselves a bunch of different things to choose from, things that are substantially different from one another and that test our assumptions about what's important to us. Oftentimes, decision making is boiled down to single alternatives and single objectives, and to me that speaks more to what an ultimatum looks like than what a really good decision looks like. And then I think lastly, people just really struggle with trade-offs. The idea that you have to give up something that you value in exchange for something else that you also value but for different reasons, this causes all kinds of conflict in the mind. And we're just not really good at making those kinds of trade-offs. So across all four of those dimensions, the work that I do and that my colleagues do is really focused on trying to get people to make better decisions.
Well, we get frustrated, too, about the amount of information that's around. Does big data really help make better decisions?
Well, it certainly could. You know, we certainly have no shortage of it out there right now. I think the pitfall that we face with big data is that we use it in the wrong way, if you will. So if we have a decision to make, a first instinct is for us to sort of scan the horizon to see what kind of data in the big data set out there is that sort of at our fingertips, and we try and kind of plug it into the decision that we're making. In my view, what we really ought to be doing instead is asking ourselves, what is it that we're trying to achieve with the decisions that we're making? How is it that we're going to measure success or failure or progress or lack thereof with respect to those goals and objectives? And then and only then to say, okay, now that we know what we want and how we measure it, let's see if big data has some answers for us. So it becomes, big data becomes, or should become in my view, something that's in service to decision making, not necessarily something that drives decision making. And if big data doesn't have the answer for us, then I think that then calls upon us to do additional new data collection that answers our questions. But to think that the answers are just out there because they must be, I think is naive and problematic.
Bringing this back down to the personal level, our listeners already care about climate change, but you say there are right and wrong ways to communicate about it. How should they go about it?
Our research suggests that focusing on the causes of climate change, particularly the human causes of climate change, and focusing on the human and environmental impacts of climate change are going to be where the most traction is gained. That's not to say that focusing on the technical dimensions of climate change isn't going to be important, but if we really want to see people raise their concern and potentially be at least open to the idea of changing their behavior, those in our research seem to be the places where there's the most promise. That said, kind of tying that question to the things that we just talked about, knowledge is really only the thin end of the wedge. It's really what kind of gets us in the door, gets people aware and concerned. The next step is to actually do the heavy lifts on the decision-making side. And I think that's where we often fail when it comes to things like climate change, is we assume that, well, we can educate people, we can build their knowledge, we can raise their awareness and their concern. And then some magic will happen. They'll come about, they'll have an about face on climate change, and they'll suddenly make better decisions. And the reality is that that's not how it works. There are big gaps, big gulfs between the quality of our decisions and our sort of awareness of problems and our knowledge that we still need to address. But then taking the next step to decision support, I think, is absolutely essential.
We have been talking with Professor Joseph Arvai. He's the director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. Joe is co-author of the new letter just published in the journal Nature Climate Change, titled Knowledge as a Driver of Public Perceptions About Climate Change Reassessed. Find links to this paper and Joe's work in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Joe, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Radio EcoShock.